I don't know how other speakers do it, but sometimes you come up with a subject that you study for a discourse, and then when you're all done studying, you think, well, what title would go with this? And other times you come up with a title, and you say, now how can I develop this title? And this subject is one that I heard the title, and I said, boy, that title deserves a discourse, The Miracle Worker. And I mentioned that to Sister Cheryl, that I wanted to use this as a title for a talk, and she said, so you're going to speak about Helen Keller and Ann Sullivan? And I says, well, what are you talking about? Why'd you say that? And she says, well, that's the name of the movie that was made about their lives. And that intrigued me. I knew a little bit about Helen Keller. I didn't know enough. So I looked into it further. I found the movie. I watched it. I loved it. And I found a wonderful human interest story in Helen Keller and Ann Sullivan. And I'd like to look at this story as a real-life human interest parable that I believe contains lessons and some profound insights into how a mind that was in utter darkness could be brought to enlightenment and reach its potential, not in spite of its physical difficulties, but because of its physical difficulties, that she reached a greater potential than she could have reached had she been a normal little girl. And in many ways, I see her story parallel the work that God is doing with mankind. You know, we all realize that the journey of mankind through the perils of life have created endless lessons and examples that are going to form part of mankind's experiences and memories for ages to come. And mankind is going to reach its full potential, not in spite of the Adamic curse, but they're going to reach a greater potential because of the Adamic curse. And so we see some wonderful parallels here. Now, if you remember the story, Helen Keller was deaf and blind almost from birth. She was 19 months old when she encountered some serious illness. We're not sure today what it actually was, possibly scarlet fever or meningitis. And as a young girl, I'm going to skip these. She was described as almost a feral child. Now, a feral child is a child who lives isolated from human contact from a very young age and has no experience with human care or social interaction or even of human language. You know, parents, Helen Keller's parents, loved her very much. But they just didn't know how to interact with her and to deal with her challenging problems. And so they just let Helen do whatever she wanted to do. She would kick and punch and rebel at anything they tried to make her do that she didn't want to do. And so she became this feral, this almost animal-like child. This is how one website described her. It says, Helen was an unruly, spoiled child who tyrannized the household with her temper tantrums. Now, if you've ever seen one of the few movies that have been made about her life, there's one scene where the family is having a dinner. That's the quote. Thank you. If you've ever seen that movie about her life, there's one scene in the movie where the family is having a dinner, and there was no place set for Helen. She was allowed to just kind of walk around the table and help herself from anyone's plate and just feed herself with it. And the reason they did that is because she couldn't do these things for herself. And so as long as she got what she wanted, she was happy and they could have a nice, quiet supper. Well, they were very distraught about her condition, of course, and they were considering putting her in an institution. And eventually they were directed to an institution for the blind in Boston. But even that institution wasn't capable of dealing with her multiple handicaps. And so the director of the school asked a former student by the name of Ann Sullivan to become her personal instructor, that she needed personal care that an institute couldn't provide. But Ann Sullivan was an extraordinary, unique person. And what made her unique and probably the most qualified person to do what she did was her own challenges. Here's a quote about Ann Sullivan's life. She was afflicted with trachoma. Anne had begun to lose her eyesight due to corneal scarring at age 3 and was virtually blind by the age of 5. When she was 8, her mother died of tuberculosis, and when she was 10, her father, an abusive alcoholic, abandoned both her and her younger brother at a poorhouse. Her brother, also suffering from tuberculosis, soon died. through various benefactors, Anne received a series of operations on her eyes. Eventually, her sight was restored enough that she could read for short periods. Now, you're going to see in some of the pictures that we show of her, she was always wearing dark sunglasses. That wasn't to be cool. That was because of the sensitivity of her eyes. This girl is really the hero of the story. She was very intelligent. She was a determined young girl just to get through the issues that she had in life. And it was in 1886, in spite of her own problems, she accepted the invitation to be Helen Keller's tutor. Helen was 6 years old at the time. And then when she got to Alabama, where the Kellers were, she attended her first family dinner. And you can imagine that how she watched in horror at the way Helen was allowed to help herself from everyone's plate. And she demanded to know why they allowed her to do this. And they explained that it just simply kept the peace. Just let it be and everything will be all right. And Anne said some profound things that really tie into the wisdom that God uses in dealing with mankind. She said, if you want to help your daughter, you have to discipline her. But her parents didn't think that Helen was intelligent enough to understand discipline. Well, the next thing that Anne Sullivan does, she gets up from the table. She goes over to Helen. She grabs the food out of her hand. She grabs it even out of her mouth. She pulls up a chair and she sits her down in the chair. And you can imagine the brawl that resulted from a spoiled child for the first time in her life being treated this way. It was the first time Helen experienced any discipline in her life, that her behavior had been challenged. And so the next thing that Anne Sullivan does, she demands that everyone leave the room. She locked the door, the two doors to the dining room. She sits Helen down again. She puts a spoon in her hand, and she forces her to eat. Spoon after spoon went flying across the room, and it was a scene of chaos. Helen would run around the room, but the doors were locked, so she couldn't get out, and Anne would eventually catch her, drag her back to the table, sit her down, and force her to eat. And it's an amazing scene in the movie, but the movie graciously cuts away from that scene. And the next scene you see in the movie shows Helen's mother outside on the porch waiting and listening to all the commotion. And Anne and Helen finally stumble out of the house. They're exhausted and ragged and tired. And Anne said to Helen's mother, she ate with from her own plate with a spoon, and she folded her own napkin. The room is a wreck, but the napkin is folded. And of course, the mother couldn't believe it. They had never been able to teach Helen anything. And here in the first encounter, Anne Sullivan teaches her some beginnings of discipline. And so this was the inauspicious beginning of what I think is one of the great human dramas of the education of a human mind. A mind that was just as blind and deaf as her natural senses. Anne was to discover that Helen's mind was not deficient, like her parents thought. In fact, she was very intelligent, but somehow Anne had to communicate with Helen. Because of her disabilities and animal-like behavior, communication was nearly impossible, and you can understand why. But this lady Anne, this young girl Anne, was determined. And she started using sign language. And of course, because Helen couldn't see or hear, she started doing sign language in her hand so she could at least feel what the sign language was. And of course, Helen had no idea what these little motions in her hand were all about. And there's one scene in the movie when Helen's mother saw Anne doing this, and she asked her what she was doing. She had never seen it before. And Anne Sullivan said that she was spelling out words. Here, I'm sorry, it's a scene on the right. And her mother said, well, does she understand? And Anne said, oh, no, she'll have to understand what words are first. And the mother says, well, when will she learn that? And Anne said, it will take at least 1,000,000 words before she starts understanding concepts that these words are spelling out. 1,000,000 words to understand simple things that you and I take for granted all the time. And I think what a challenge that she was about to embark on. And what nobility we see in Anne Sullivan to make the commitment that she did. She was only 20 years old when this happened. But rather than think that that was a a negative thing that she was so young. I think her youth is what gave her the strength to do what she did. You know, young people tend to be very idealistic. And they're not afraid to do something that maybe some of us older ones would say, I don't have the energy for that. But here was a young girl who could see a need because she had experienced a similar need in herself that she could help with. And so she wasn't afraid to tackle one of the most difficult human challenges that a person could have. Brethren, try to imagine how difficult it would be to be blind and deaf virtually from birth. I tried to close my eyes and plug my ears for a while just to try to comprehend in the smallest way what that might be. And it's awful. There's no outside light or sound or interaction whatsoever. And not to know what words are, or that words make up sentences and sentences describe things and people. Well, losing both of her senses at such a young age took all that away from Helen Keller. At one point, Helen's father was having a conversation with Ann Sullivan. And I want to read you a couple of sentences because Ann Sullivan says some simply profound things. After some initial success at controlling Helen's behavior, her father came to Ann Sullivan with her first month's salary, and he expressed his appreciation. He said, "This doesn't begin to pay the debt that we owe you." But Ann responded very bluntly. She said, "I've taught her one thing. No, don't do this, don't do that. I wanted to teach her what language is. I know without it to do nothing but obey is no gift. Obedience without understanding is blindness too. Is that all I've wished on her? I don't know what else to do. Simply going on doing what I've done and have faith that inside she's waiting like water underground. I don't want her just to obey, but to let her have her way is being alive to her." Brethren, I think that that description of Anne's vision for Helen Keller is an amazing description of why God has permitted evil in this world. That phrase, obedience without understanding, if you had to summarize the divine plan in one statement, that really is a kernel thought. Obedience without understanding is blindness. Doesn't that describe Adam and Eve? They were told not to eat of one tree. They weren't told why. They weren't told the philosophy behind it. They didn't understand who it was, really, who was asking them for this simple thing. They didn't understand that when God said something or asked them to do something, he always had their best interests at heart, that he would never ask them to do something that wasn't for their own good. And so in a sense, they were blind to the goodness of God and the principles that were behind it. That disobedience has led to severe consequences for mankind. But I like what Aunt Sullivan said. If you want to help your daughter, you have to discipline her. In the fall of man, we see that the father is disciplining his children. Though Helen's parents loved her, they really weren't good parents because they didn't know how to discipline a disobedient daughter. They felt sorry for her, and they didn't do what she really needed. But God does know what we all need and what our race needs. He wants us to understand principles. He desires all of us in the world to do what is right and good because we all see the value in those things. Now, blind obedience might be okay for a young child. But in the end, blind obedience is not the noblest reasons for actions. When Aunt Sullivan said there at the bottom, to let her have her way is being alive to her, I think she was making another profound statement. If I had to reword that, I think she's saying with understanding comes the most beneficial exercise of free will. And we see that when mankind is properly enlightened to the principles of God, they will be able to choose to live righteous lives. But when free will is exercised without the proper enlightenment from God, it cannot choose the proper way to live in every circumstance. And that's where Adam and Eve were way back then. Well, in the story, after only a short time with the Keller family, Anne decided that she had to get Helen away from her family, that they were undermining everything that she was doing. And she wanted to really take her away, but the father wouldn't. He was very protective. He wouldn't let her go until finally he was convinced that they had a small cottage on their property, and he would let Anne Sullivan take Helen to this cottage that was right near their house for 2 weeks. And if there wasn't significant progress in 2 weeks, Anne Sullivan would have to leave. Well, it was an intense 2 weeks of personal one-on-one training. And after the 2 weeks, Helen was brought back to her family. And her behavior changed significantly. And so the family was so thrilled that her behavior had improved, they planned a nice dinner and they made all the food, Helen's favorite foods. But it's interesting what happened at that dinner. Helen did something very interesting. First, she dropped her napkin on the floor. And at first, Anne thought that it was just a slip, and so she picked it up and gave it back to her. And then she dropped it again. And Anne picked it up again. And then Helen began eating with her hands. She was testing her parents to see that, to see if they would be more lenient than Anne Sullivan had been. And they were. They said, you know, we're so glad to have her back with us. What harm will it do to let her have her way just this once? But, you know, that would have undone everything that Anne Sullivan had accomplished. And Anne was furious. And she said, you're going to undo everything I've done with her. And then she made another profound statement. She said, she will live up to just what you demand of her. Helen was comfortable with her old habits. She wanted to go back to the way it was before. Even after 2 weeks of enforced discipline, she wanted to be the old Helen without Anne Sullivan's influence. And I think about that and I see, you know, Helen was very much like the world of mankind. People in the world have lived their whole lives a certain way. And I think in the kingdom they're going to want to come back to their certain ways, at least some of them. The scriptures tell us that in the kingdom the Lord is going to rule them with a rod of iron. When kingdom laws will be enforced, they will have to obey. They will be under the Anne Sullivan tutorial system. But someday, mankind is going to test God's system. We know that the little season at the end of the millennium will be the world's final test. And you know, I think the circumstances that might create that opportunity is what Brother George was talking about when he was talking about the ancient worthies possibly receiving a heavenly reward after the kingdom. You know, if they're taken off the scene, as we think they will be at the end of the kingdom, there's going to be a power void, an authority vacuum. And that might be the opportunity for people to say, well, you know, things look like they're different. Things are changing now. Let's do a little testing. Maybe someone will just drop a napkin. Maybe they'll just do some little thing to test the kingdom system. And if there's no immediate discipline, maybe they'll do something even worse, just to see if the rules have changed. And as difficult as it is for us to comprehend anyone being so dense that they're missing the point in the kingdom, it's going to happen. And it's evident the people that, who do that in the little season just didn't get the whole point of the kingdom. God's ultimate goal for mankind is not to demand obedience. It's about teaching people to want to do good from their own hearts without being forced to do it. That is so much more challenging than enforcing people to obey. But God is determined to teach the world that the meaning of life can only be found on a higher and nobler plane than most people are living on today. Of course, a turning point in the story of Anne Sullivan and Helen Keller happened just after that scene at the dinner table where Helen was testing her parents' resolve. Anne wasn't going to allow her to slip back into her old habits. And so she did what she did at that first dinner. She grabs the food out of her hands. She grabs it out of her mouth. And as you might expect, there was another temper tantrum. And Helen felt around the table and she grabbed a pitcher of water and she threw it in the direction of Anne Sullivan, and Anne Sullivan got drenched. And Anne Sullivan was so angry, she was Irish, I guess that didn't help, but she was so angry that she dragged Helen outside to the water pump and she was going to make her fill the water pitcher. And while they were filling the pitcher, she put one hand of Helen under the water, and in the other hand, she was spelling out the word water. You see, she was in a constant position of wanting to teach this girl how to communicate. And as Helen felt the water running over her hand, a light finally came on, and she stopped, and Helen took Anne's hand, and she spelled out the word water. It was the first time that she understood what Anne had been doing all this time. It finally dawned on her that letters created words and that words described things. The letters W-A-T-E-R stood for the liquid that she was feeling on her hand. It was the breakthrough that Anne had been hoping for. Now, that doesn't sound like much to us, that she could comprehend that five letters equal water. But it was the first connection that she made between the signals in her hand and something real and tangible that she could identify. Helen learned 30 new words that day, and in the next 6 months, she learned some 350 new words. Now, what I'm going to do now is a little unconventional, and I hope this doesn't offend anyone. I hope not. But I was so impressed by this singular moment. Brother Harry used the phrase the aha moment. This is an aha moment for one girl. But I was so impressed at the symbolism that we could see in the aha moment here that I want to show you the last few minutes of the movie so you can kind of experience it yourself. It is such a cool moment for someone in Helen's position. And I think, imagine where Helen would have been without the care, the concern, the discipline, and the wisdom that Anne Sullivan brought into her life. So we're going to just watch a few minutes of this movie.
Yeah.
I'll stop it there. There's so many neat things that happened in those few minutes. One of the highlights in this experience was after this great breakthrough, Helen came over to Ann Sullivan, and for the first time that she had met her, she wanted to know who she was. And Ann, of course, signed that she was the teacher. And then you notice that Helen went over to her mother and she found two keys in her pockets. Well, she knew they were there because she had put them there. They were the keys that Ann Sullivan had used to lock the dining room door. And the first thing that Helen did when she came back from those 2 weeks was go hide those keys because she didn't want to be locked in the dining room with Ann Sullivan again. But here now she takes the keys and she gives them back to Ann Sullivan. Her mother had no idea why those keys were there. But what she was in essence saying is, now I understand why you did what you did. And I won't fight you anymore. I know you're on my side trying to help me. And at the very end of the movie, that's why we went that far, Helen comes out, finds Ann sitting on the porch, and she sits on her lap and she kisses her. They had been mortal enemies up to that point until Helen finally understood that this woman is here to help me, to bless me. She's my friend. And I like to connect that with the scripture in Psalms about kissing the Son of Man, that there's a relationship there that will someday develop, that mankind will feel closeness to their Savior. Brethren, these things make me think of how many times these moments of recognition will occur in the kingdom. People who will have fought tooth and nail against the enforced rules of the kingdom will at some point have their minds enlightened when they see the value of what the Lord is at first demanding of them. And then they will turn to the Lord in their own personal aha moment and they'll say, so you're the teacher. You're the one with the keys of discipline that has taught me to do good. Thank you for not giving up on me. Thank you for having the wisdom to know what I need to be complete and find my meaning in life. And these people will seek out the Lord because they will appreciate finally all that He has done for them, even when they hated them, even when they persecuted Him and His followers. And like I said, as the psalmist said, they will kiss the Son and put their trust in Him. I can't wait for that to happen. And so in the case of Helen Keller, I ask, was it a miracle that this animal-like child who was totally separated from her surroundings could eventually connect with the outside world, become a world traveler, a famous writer and lecturer? No, it wasn't a miracle. It was a result of tremendous perseverance by her teacher. It was Anne's belief that discipline was vital and that Helen had great potential. If only she could learn to see things without using her eyes and to hear things without using her ears. And she did. And there again we see a reflection of God's wisdom. The scriptures say, my son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord or loathe his reproof. For whom the Lord loves, he reproves, even as a father corrects a son in whom he delights. How blessed is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding. And then the Apostle Paul adds this after quoting that passage in Proverbs. He says, all discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it afterwards, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. And as I read that scripture, I recall the scene when Helen struggled against the discipline that Ann Sullivan was enforcing upon her. And I think after it was all settled and done, I think what a feeling of satisfaction that Ann Sullivan must have experienced as she saw the light go on in Helen's mind. And then as she matured and grew into the potential that Ann had seen in her. And I wonder too, brethren, the personal satisfaction that Jesus must have felt as he performed miracles and helped people while he was here on the earth. Now, he was a real miracle worker. The four Gospels actually record 37 miracles that Jesus did, but these were only a small sampling of the many miracles that he actually performed. And we know this because the Apostle John says, Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would be written. I think part of the reason that God gave Jesus this power was to impress upon the people of the land who he was and where he came from, that he was sent by God, that Jesus was someone special. The Apostle John says, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. And then Jesus also said, the works that I do bear witness of me, that the Father hath sent me. Well, for many who saw the miracles, they worked just the way they were intended to work. After working some amazing miracles, Matthew says that when the crowd saw this, they were awestruck and glorified God who hath given such authority to men. And I think, you know, if we were there sitting and watching Jesus perform these amazing miracles, my goodness, we would certainly be convinced. You know, what would it take to convince you that Jesus was the Son of God when he can do these miraculous things? In Matthew 9:3, it says, as he looked at the vast crowds, he was deeply moved with pity for them, for they were as bewildered and miserable as a flock of sheep with no shepherd. And I think what that verse is saying is that, yes, the miracles were to prove who he was. But it's also saying that the miracles meant a lot more than that to Jesus. I think that Jesus saw himself as a shepherd, and he saw the people as bewildered and miserable sheep, and the instinctive nature of a shepherd, he loves his sheep. He wants to care for them. He wants to bless them. So I think there was a real personal investment on Jesus' feelings and emotions as he helped people. In the 9th chapter alone, there were miracle after miracle. In verse 1, he healed a paralyzed man. Then he healed a woman with the issue of blood. He raised the daughter of a temple official from the dead. He healed 2 blind men. He cast out a demon from a blind man, and then he healed the blind man's eyes. And then in verse 35, it says, Jesus was going through all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. So we only have a small touch of the many things that he did. And I think he loved doing them. I think he treasured the opportunities of lifting people up. In the 12th chapter of Matthew, he continued his work of healing. It says that large crowds followed him, and he healed them all. Then in verse 20, we see something unique and special about Jesus. We see a gentleness in him that sometimes we miss, because part of his ministry was tough words. But there's a gentleness in Jesus that we can easily miss in the Gospels. It says in Matthew 12:20, a battered reed he will not break off, and a smoldering wick he will not put out, until he leads forth justice to victory, and in his name the Gentiles will hope. And I love the thought encompassed in that phrase, a battered reed he will not break off. Barnes commentary has a really nice thought on this. It says, the reed is an emblem of feebleness. A bruised, broken reed is an emblem of the poor and oppressed. It means that he would not oppress the feeble and poor. He will not break it. That is, he will not be severe, unforgiving, and cruel. Isn't that a nice description of the sweet disposition that was in Jesus, that was a natural part of him? He looked at people who were suffering through merciful eyes. He wasn't there to crush them. He was there to lift them up, to make them better, to make them stronger. He loved the people that he helped. Brother Russell says, if there be even a slight disposition to penitence, he fosters and cherishes it. I love that. But then on the other hand, Jesus didn't like hypocrisy. He had harsh words for the pretentious Pharisees. And sometimes the harsh words masked the true gentleness that was in his heart. But when there was a flicker of faith, it was like a bruised reed that had to be handled carefully so as not to harm it. The next part of the verse has a similar meaning when it says that a smoldering wick he will not put out. Barnes' commentary again says something really nice. It says, this refers to the wick of a lamp when the oil is exhausted, the dying, flickering flame and smoke that hang over it. He would not further oppress those who had a little strength. He would not put out hope and life when it seemed to be almost extinct. It is expressive also of the languishing graces of the people of God. He will not treat them harshly or unkindly, but will cherish the feeble flame, minister the oil of grace, and kindle it into a blaze. Again, I think that's a lovely way of saying that the Lord will not just dismiss us if he sees that we're struggling with our faith. If our faith, it says there, is like a smoldering wick, he will do what he can to flame it, to bring it back to passion. And I think it's an indication of how much Jesus wants us to succeed. He's not there as our cruel judge to take account of every shortcoming or every sin. He's there to foster us, to strengthen us, to love us and care for us. He wants to see us mature and grow. As long as our faith isn't completely gone, as long as there's that faint flicker, he will do what he can to reignite it. Well, earlier in Matthew, the 12th chapter, Jesus had gone into the synagogue and there was a man with a withered hand. And the Pharisees were there. And somehow they could sense that Jesus was about to do something. And they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And Jesus said, what man is there among you who has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath? Will he not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable then is a man than a sheep? So then it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. Then he said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out and it was restored to normal like the other. But the Pharisees went out and conspired against him as to how they might destroy him. Well, I'm not going to dwell on the Pharisees. I think Jesus' expression shows us how much he valued human life. He was expressing compassion for the bruised reeds that needed his healing touch. And in spite of those objections or those blind to this wonderful truth, he healed the man before him. And I think, well, you know, when the Pharisees looked at this guy, they saw someone unholy, someone who wasn't worthy, perhaps, of their time and attention, certainly not worthy of being healed on the Sabbath. But when Jesus looked at him, he saw someone valuable, someone worth healing, someone worth saving. And that's the difference between the way some people look at others and the way Jesus looks at them. Jesus sees value in everyone. Because he knows that with some work, with some discipline, with some education, with experience, with a little polishing in the kingdom, every person has great potential and great value. And I'll say that was the gift that Ann Sullivan possessed. She could see the potential in Helen Keller. And with her help, she was able to reach that potential. We're going to have to skip to the end. I think I've said enough. Well, brethren, human interest stories to me are always moving because the divine plan is all about a human interest story. God has an interest in mankind. He has an interest in our suffering because he knows with our suffering and with the balancing experiences of the kingdom, man will reach their full potential, greater potential than we could have reached had we not had the permission of evil. And so in our Father's dealings with us and with the world of mankind, we see unparalleled wisdom that we can't fully comprehend until we reach the goal for ourselves and for the world of mankind. And may the Lord help us to reach that goal as quick as we can.